Sheldrake on Shakespeare. Hamlet, is anything original? Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Sheldrake on Shakespeare. Firstly, a plug for the live shows. The very first preview of Sheldrake on Shakespeare live takes place this Friday, 2nd of June, at the Etc. Theatre in Camden, followed shortly by one in Oxford at the Old Fire Station on Thursday the 8th. Tickets are selling well, but there are still seats I would dearly love to fill. So if you are free, and obviously not listening to this episode from your beach hut in the Bahamas or somewhere else exotic, please book via the links in the description. I would be so grateful to have a full house for the first test drives of the show, and I suppose you may even enjoy yourselves. Tickets are an extremely reasonable, in my view, £10, and for that you get an hour of wit, anecdote, insight, performance and laughter, as I introduce a handful of Shakespeare's most playful characters and poke fun at some of the ways our approach to Shakespeare has become far too serious over the last four centuries. It will not be, I should say, just a live recording of an hour-long podcast episode. Live performance is a very different beast from this sort of format, hence the tagline for the live show, "What Keith Floyd was to food, this show is to Shakespeare." If you don't know who Keith Floyd is, spend a fruitful couple of hours on YouTube or BBC iPlayer finding out. It is difficult to know where to begin with Hamlet. What can there be left to say about the most written about play by the most written about writer in the language? You are not the first to feel this. In 1908, Horace Howard Furness, an editor of Hamlet, began a lecture to undergraduates at Harvard University by saying that he was convinced that were he told that his closest friend was lying at the point of death and that his life could be saved by permitting him to divulge his theory of Hamlet, he would instantly say, "Let him die, let him die, let him die." Nonetheless, I have broken the habit of a podcast and written two episodes for Hamlet. I don't think this is mere indecision on my part. Indeed, I think the play and the history of our relationship with it rather demand that approach. On the one hand, we have praised its intellectual calibre to a point where a tremendous forest of academic barbed wire has grown up around it. It is a very intellectual play, but it is also a simple plot, and I love the play much more for its dramatic force than because it is clever. In the second episode, I'm going to talk about how Shakespeare deploys certain rhetorical features and how they reflect some of the bigger ideas of the play. It's likely to be the most technically intricate episode of the podcast series, which may be a turn-on or a turn-off for you. But in this first one, I wanted to find a way of talking about the plot without merely doing a rehash of what happens. And the best way into that is to think about Shakespeare's source material for the play. As you may know, very little of what happens in Shakespeare's plays is original. The vast majority are adapted from other stories and texts. This is obvious for the plays about English and classical history, but it is true of almost all the comedies and tragedies as well. They may be adapted from a single source, or cobbled together from a few stories and myths, or even adapted from other plays. This level of adaptation was not regarded as plagiarism, quite the opposite. One of the measures of genius in the period was the ability to take classical stories and refashion them in interesting and fresh ways. One of the reasons it is interesting to compare Shakespeare's plays with their sources is because it seems to offer us a rare opportunity to cast some light on Shakespeare's creative process. We would love to be able to get inside Shakespeare's head for a moment, wouldn't we, to know how he approached what he was writing. That is impossible because we have no record at all of what Shakespeare personally thought about any of his writing or indeed anything else. Now, with any of his language and creative decisions, we can, of course, imagine what the alternatives might be, and it can be a very useful teaching tool to ask the question, how would this line be different if Shakespeare had used this other word instead? But most of the time, we don't have different versions of individual lines or words. There are no early drafts of these plays, for example. We just have the more or less completed versions. Comparing them to their source material is therefore a rare opportunity to work out what he explicitly decided to change and to read into that, carefully but hopefully, something concrete about the process by which these plays were created. Let us then apply this lens to Hamlet. In looking back at the source material, I was struck by quite how many features of this play's plot already existed in other forms. There are three main sources that we still have access to. Firstly, a Danish historian called Saxo Grammaticus seems to have recorded a story along these lines in about 1200 AD, which was then printed in a history book in 1514. In this version, the son is called Amleth, A-M-L-E-T-H, which is a small step to Shakespeare's Hamlet. But Shakespeare is the only person who handles this story to call both father and son Hamlet. So the first observation we might make is that Shakespeare wants to make it explicit that we should be comparing the son with the father, or perhaps that the character of Prince Hamlet should have as many reasons as possible to compare himself with his father. Towards the end of the Saxo Grammaticus version, Amleth gets the courtiers drunk and sets fire to the banqueting hall. He swaps his sword for the wicked king's and kills him with it. Amleth is proclaimed king and has his adventures engraved on his shield. It is an obvious difference that Hamlet dies tragically in Shakespeare's version, and Fortinbras, also a Shakespearean invention, becomes the next king of Denmark by force. The adventures being engraved on the shield finds expression in Horatio, Hamlet's dear friend, who is tasked by Hamlet with keeping his story alive after Hamlet's death. The spoken word, in Shakespeare's view perhaps, is more powerful and enduring than mere physical monuments. The second source for the plot is from a writer called François de Belforest, who translated into French a historical work by an Italian historian, Matteo Bandello. Belforest makes a few tweaks to the story, most prominently that in his version it is public knowledge that the king murdered his brother. Shakespeare makes it a secret again, so that Hamlet needs to test the truth of the ghost's claims, and I'll expand on the importance of this in a minute. Thirdly, The Spanish Tragedy is a 1589 play by Thomas Kyd, and it's not a source in the sense that it features the same characters, but it does have a ghost, a play within a play, a faithful friend called Horatio, a brother who kills his sister's lover, and a woman's suicide. So you can see how some furniture was likely borrowed from that to put into the house that Shakespeare was building around Hamlet. I should also say that there was a play of unknown title and unknown author performed in 1587 that we now refer to as the Ur-Hamlet. Ur, is a German word meaning original. A later writer refers to this event, which is how we know about it at all. Do look up what we think we know about that play if you want to explore this area further, but because we know so little about it, I am leaving it to one side. That's not great scholarship from me, perhaps, but in the absence of the whole truth, I think it's permissible to build a slightly speculative argument on which to hang our ideas. One thing to take away from these summaries, therefore, is quite how ready Shakespeare was to repurpose and adapt elements of the story in its previous versions into his own Frankenstein's monster. So we might be thinking to ourselves at this point, we can see that he's making small alterations as he goes along, but is there any sizable decision Shakespeare made to do things very differently? Is anything about this play truly original? Yes, there is. In terms of content, Shakespeare does seem to introduce the Laertes, Ophelia, and Polonius characters pretty much from scratch. The plotline exists in some form in the Saxo Grammaticus version. Some courtiers become suspicious of Amleth and try to trap him into confessing his desire to avenge the murder of his father. They try using a young girl to catch him off guard, and when this doesn't work, they plant a spy in his mother's bedchamber. Amleth is warned of the first trap. For the second, he identifies the spy, kills him, and feeds him to the pigs. Yes, you heard me. Feeds him to the pigs. Ophelia and Polonius fulfill exactly the same roles in Shakespeare's version, but they are much more central and coherent characters. Also, Shakespeare has made this much more personal and dramatic by deciding that Hamlet will realise, whilst Ophelia is talking to him, that Claudius and Polonius, her father, are spying on him. Then it is Polonius who is murdered as the spy in Gertrude's chamber, though Hamlet thinks he is murdering Claudius, of course. So Shakespeare has introduced some tragic mistaken identity here and heightened the drama, but toned down the sheer brutality. Hamlet feeds no one to the pigs. Shakespeare also introduces the idea of poison as the murder weapon, both of King Hamlet and for Prince Hamlet at the end of the play. Poison is a deceitful weapon, of course, so I think this highlights what a Machiavellian political operator, the new king, Claudius, is. And in terms of style, we could certainly say that the soliloquies and the introspective nature of the character of Hamlet are innovations by Shakespeare. This is no small innovation, and has indeed shaped much of our perception of what it is to be human during the last 400 years. We might say it's not a plot innovation as such, but I think it does give us a nudge in the right direction. I think the most original and imaginative decision that Shakespeare makes is to do something very different with the play within the play compared to Thomas Kyd's Spanish tragedy. In that play, theatre is the method of revenge. Hieronymo, the father whose son has been murdered, convinces the murderers to perform with him in a play in Act 5. Whilst the rest of the court is looking on, he literally stabs them, enacting his revenge, but the other courtiers don't intervene until it's too late because they think their friends are just giving a very good performance of dying. Shakespeare instead uses the play, The Mousetrap, as Hamlet rightly calls it, to test what the ghost has claimed. The ghost of Hamlet's father, who appeared in Act 1, claimed that he was murdered by his brother. But outside that, Hamlet has no proof and does not want to risk his own soul by murdering a man who may be innocent. So Hamlet persuades the players, some travelling actors visiting the royal castle, to stage a very similar event, and Claudius can't help himself but rise from his seat at the moment of the acted murder. Prince Hamlet takes this as proof that he is guilty, and Claudius shortly confirms to the audience that he did indeed murder his brother. This leaves Prince Hamlet open to pursue his revenge. So what? Well, there are lots of moments in Shakespeare where theatre and performance have a significant effect on people. But the difference with Claudius in Hamlet is that he doesn't want to be affected by this play. He immediately regrets that he has risen from his chair, and even Hamlet is surprised that the mousetrap has caught its rat. What, frighted with false fire? He asks himself. So at the heart of Shakespeare's greatest play is a statement of profound belief in the power of live theatre to reach into the hearts of even those who want to resist it. In Tom Stoppard's magical film Shakespeare in Love, there is a wonderful scene where a Puritan preacher is standing outside the theatre just before the first performance of Romeo and Juliet. He's ranting on about the sinfulness of it all, how cross-dressing and playing your social superiors will lead to sure moral downfall and damnation. The crowds are so great, however, that he is swept against his will into the yard, and they're packed in so tightly that he has no choice but to watch the play. The play happens, and as the actors take their bows, the camera cuts back to the Puritan preacher, blowing kisses to the actors with tears in his eyes, his mask a face of wild adoration and affection at this beautiful and moving tragedy. And in a way, we are all the ideological Puritan or the guilty Claudius about something. We all have our prejudices, and we all have things on our conscience. And being human, we don't want either of them disrupted. Live theatre has the power, like few other things, to pass through our imagination and to stir our depths, good or ill. We might say, well, he would, wouldn't he? Shakespeare would have a profound belief in the power of theatre to change hearts and minds, but I think you need look no further than the history of his own plays for proof of that belief. I'm sure you can all think of occasions in which you have ended up in a Shakespeare play or elsewhere, sympathising with a character with whom you thought you could never sympathise, or considering something from a point of view that had never occurred to you before. We engage emotionally even though we sometimes want to fend off the prick to our consciences. So a comparison of Shakespeare's greatest play with its source material has revealed that, sure, he didn't feel the need to reinvent the wheel. He was a snapper-up of unconsidered trifles, as one of his characters puts it. Perhaps we should think of him as a gigantic recycling depot, processing every old tale under the sun and panning through them for something dramatically salvageable. But more importantly, it's revealed something I've never really thought about in these terms before. At the heart of his greatest play, and it is in terms of structure exactly in the middle of the play, Act 3, Scene 2, lies an assertion and demonstration of theatre's unique power to touch the human soul. In the Spanish tragedy, the play within the play was the method of revenge, a brilliant theatrical moment, but fundamentally a tool for concealment. In Hamlet, theatre is not how you create a lie, it's how you reveal the truth. You have been listening to a Sheldrake on Shakespeare podcast. Do please review, like, share, and book your tickets for the live show. Thank you for listening, and farewell.